on the Michael Coolidge Show. Our next guest is clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School. He's also the author of the conservative news and legal blog Legal Insurrection. Welcome back on to the Michael Coolidge Show, William Jacobson.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Yes, we're excited to talk with you about this John Doe law, this conservative witch hunt, essentially, that's been going on in Wisconsin started about 6 years ago. And this sort of thing is really, really scary that our government can actually do this kind of thing and get away with it. But before we get into any of that, I got to ask your opinion about the vice presidential debate from Tuesday night. How'd you think it went? Or was it Monday night? Whenever it was. How did you think it went?
Yeah, the days do seem to melt into each other. I was left with the feeling that wondering why Mike Pence wasn't the presidential nominee, because he was so much better on his feet than Donald Trump. And I wonder if Trump had given the performance that Pence gave, I think the polling would be very different nowadays. I think Trump was rising in the polls as we approached his the presidential debate. It was not a good night for him by any account, and he has sunk pretty significantly, several percentage points since then. And I just think that if he were on as prepared as Pence was prepared, if he was on message as much, if he didn't take the bait the way Pence never took the bait, I think we could be in a very different spot here. That said, I don't know that a vice presidential debate changes a lot of votes. I think it can change the atmosphere. And I do think it changed the atmosphere a little bit. I think it undid some of the damage done to Trump by the debate that he participated in. And I think there probably are a lot more people out there thinking, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to vote for him, but maybe I need to think about this again. So I think it was a net very big plus for the Republicans, even if it doesn't change a lot of votes in itself.
I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves here, but watching Mike Pence on some of the morning shows this morning and still seeing him just on and just being really sharp and unifying, really, to people on the right, I just wondered, like, has he just set himself up to be the front runner for 2020 if Donald Trump does not win in November? Because he can obviously get a lot of the Trump supporters, and he really made himself a likable person, not that he wasn't necessarily before, to conservatives and to Republicans in general from this VP debate. So if this VP debate doesn't affect this current election, does it maybe position him to be the front runner for 2020?
I don't know if it puts him as the front runner, but it certainly makes him a very serious candidate. If he had run this cycle, people would have been like, Mike Pence? What are you talking about? But
right.
Now that he's had that national audience and he performed very well, I think he's going to be a very serious candidate if he chooses to run. Whether he's the front runner or not remains to be seen, but it definitely elevated him to a top tier of people who would be considered.
Well, just over a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, if people asked who the front runner was, they might have said, at least I did actually early on, very early on, that it was Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin. And he, of course, he was one of the first, I think, to drop out. And he's been governor and still pretty popular governor in Wisconsin, the state right to our north. And we have a lot of listeners in southern Wisconsin. The last time we had you on, I think we talked about this John Doe law. For listeners who aren't aware of this craziness that happened here over the last couple of years, in a nutshell, explain what happened, and then we can get to this recent ruling that happened by the U.S. Supreme Court about it.
Right. John Doe law, which was recently amended, so it's not as bad as it used to be, but John Doe law is essentially a procedure that prosecutors can use to secretly investigate people and potential crimes. And it's very sweeping, allows them to get court-ordered search warrants, etc. And the unique thing about it was that the targets of it could not disclose to anyone but their attorney what had just happened. So what you had is you had John Doe number one, which was an investigation of Scott Walker's time as county executive. And they searched through everything, and they tried to get him, and they never got him on anything. Then there was John Doe number two, which was spearheaded by John Chisholm, the Milwaukee County prosecutor, a Democrat, whose wife was actually, I think, is aligned with the Democratic Party, again, trying to find something wrong that Scott Walker did. And the hook that they used was they said that it was illegal coordination in the recall election when Democrats tried to recall Walker, and he defeated that.
Now, can I let me interrupt you for a second here, William, because I want to ask a couple questions about this. So these people who had their homes raided by these prosecutors who had the arm of the government, people with guns, basically, knocking on people's doors, these people who they were investigated, who could not go to the press or tell anyone at all that they were being investigated, they weren't charged with any sort of crime, right? They weren't arrested for something.
No, they were not. And most of them were not even suspected of committing a crime. And what basically happened is they targeted virtually every major conservative activist and activist group in Wisconsin. And as you mentioned, they did midnight raids in the middle of the night, seized computers, cell phones, and they literally could not tell their neighbors why the police were surrounding their house and walking out with things. And it was very terrifying. A lot of people had young children at home who were rousted out of bed in the middle of the night. Records were seized. And the entire theory was that there was this illegal campaign coordination going on. And this went on for many, many months until one person finally went to the press and said, this is what's going on, at risk to himself. And so the point is that this was all trying to get Scott Walker and to bring him down. And what happened is the courts, while initially a judge had kind of rubber stamped these search warrants, another judge took a look at it and said, wait a second, everything the government's theory is of why there might be a crime here actually isn't a crime, that there is nothing illegal about what these people are alleged to have done. And what they were alleged to have done is cooperated on what they call issue advocacy. So as opposed to a group saying, I support Scott Walker, vote for him, they would run issue advocacy ads and things like that, you know, on gun control,
it sounds like PACs, like super PAC kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure technically, legally, if it's the same thing, but yes, it's the same concept that you're advertising on issues. So you might run ads, for argument's sake, saying that the union law that was passed under Walker, public sector union law, is a good thing. Okay, that's very different than saying vote for Scott Walker in the recall election. And what that initial judge held was that issue advocacy, you are allowed constitutionally to cooperate on issue advocacy. And then it went to many different courts. It went to federal court. It went and eventually went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said the entire prosecution theory is invalid, that not only does this issue advocacy not violate Wisconsin law, if it did, then that law would be unconstitutional. And so that you had 2+ years of these raids and litigation. And what it essentially did is it froze the conservative movement in Wisconsin, because with phone records and email records being seized, nobody wanted to talk to anybody. Nobody wanted to communicate with anybody because it was all subject to seizure. And so it really was a horrible situation, and they weren't even allowed to talk about it.
That's the most crazy thing is I just think of my block where I live in northern Illinois, and if I saw my next door neighbor with a bunch of police cars and people storming into his house in the middle of the night, and I ask him the next morning what went on, and I can't talk about it. People assume the worst. people assume, like, what is it? Is he being accused of child pornography here? Is it a, you know, is he running a drug operation? Like, all of these awful things. And, I mean, the people who had this happen to them could not legally say something to their neighbors for fear of being breaking the law, right? Like I just can't imagine how many people's lives were ruined here in a short period of time.
That's right. Not to mention the invasion of their privacy.
Absolutely.
Unlike Hillary Clinton, they didn't have a chance to delete 33,000 emails. And these people's privacy was completely violated. The government got to snoop into their private lives and their private political lives under a theory that was completely invalid from the get-go.
So my two big questions now, William, are what is the news this week from the U.S. Supreme Court, which decided not to see this, which is basically killing what exactly? This is good news or bad news? That's what I'm trying to understand.
It's very good news. Like I said, the Wisconsin Supreme Court threw out this law and closed the investigation. This cannot happen anymore, and the prosecutors tried to get the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the Wisconsin Supreme Court. That's a very difficult thing to do, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're not taking the case. That's what happened this week. But one important thing that happened is while this attempt was pending, somebody leaked all these sealed records that had been seized. So these people's private lives have now been exposed to the public when it was supposed to be court-sealed documents. If we don't know who did it, hopefully the Attorney General will find out about that.
The people who did this, the prosecutors, the people that decided that this was legal, or at least thought it was legal to invade people's homes and you know, under the guise of seeing if they were coordinating with Scott Walker or whatever. I mean, is there any sort of recourse that might happen to them? Or, like, are they going to be punished for this in some way? Or no, that's just, hey, that's the way the law was going. They thought it was going to go their way, and it didn't. And case closed?
Well, I don't think there's likely. It's very tough to sue a prosecutor. Now, the question is, were they acting as a prosecutor or as an investigator? That might make a difference. It's going to be very hard for a civil suit against them. That's why I think a lot of attention needs to be focused on the Wisconsin Attorney General, particularly as to the leaking of these documents, because that there was a court order sealing these documents. When the court said what you had done, prosecutors, was unlawful, and you cannot, and you have to return these records to the people you seized them from, that court order now has been undermined because the records were, in fact, leaked by somebody who had access. And the Wisconsin Attorney General needs to have an investigation as to who did that. I don't know for a fact it was the prosecutors. Of course, everybody suspects that, but we need to get to the bottom of that. And that might be
absolutely
an avenue.
Absolutely. And I guess one other solace, I guess, is that Governor Scott Walker certainly got the last laugh. He was not recalled, and he won re-election. So,
he just signed a law taking a lot of the teeth out of this John Doe law. So the result of this abusive prosecution, this abuse of the law, was that it is highly unlikely to happen again.
Speaking of people's lives who were ruined by overzealous people from the government, there's a man named Nicola Baseli, who I am going to tell you, and William Jacobson is going to tell you who that is and why his life was completely ruined by Hillary Clinton, and no one seems to care. You can stick with us for another segment, William?
Yes.
Wonderful. All right, we'll be right back with Legal Insurrections, William Jacobson, after this. Stay with us.
The Michael Coolidge Show.
We are back on The Michael Coolidge Show. We continue with William Jacobson from Legal Insurrection. So when people bring up Benghazi and you're bringing it up in the political campaign aspect, the response from the left usually goes something like, well, yeah, four people died, but this isn't the first time this happened, you know, as far as places overseas goes. I mean, Ronald Reagan in Beirut, you know, all that kind of stuff. That is obviously the most tragic thing that happened about Benghazi, is that four people died. But the second most tragic thing I would say about it, or the second worst thing about Benghazi, is the lie that was put forth by the Obama administration and, yes, Hillary Clinton about why that happened. And that response and that lie that was put out had to do with a video, if you remember. William Jacobson continues with us now from Legal Insurrection. The person who made this video, Nicola Basali, no one really talks about at all. He is an actual human being, and his life isn't exactly going well thanks to this lie that was put forth by Hillary Clinton. Was it, or is it?
That's right. I mean, everybody remembers that supposedly the first storyline from the administration, including Hillary Clinton, was that Benghazi was a spontaneous demonstration because of a video that was put out by this guy, Nicola. And she was very apologetic for it. She went on national TV. I think she even raised it when the bodies were returned to the U.S. during that
ceremony. She did. Absolutely.
One of the family members, or multiple family members, I'm not sure, of the dead, said that she told them at that ceremony that she would be sure that this video producer got brought to justice. And lo and behold, he gets arrested, and he gets arrested on a probation violation because he wasn't allowed to use the internet, and he had used it to upload the video. And so everything was focused on him. There are very famous photos of him being led away in the middle of the night for a probation violation for using the internet, all because Hillary Clinton and the administration blamed this video. Now, he shouldn't have been using the internet. We get that. But he wouldn't have been singled out like that. They wouldn't have, you know, had the equivalent of a SWAT raid on his home. He wouldn't have been all over the newspapers, et cetera, had he not been falsely blamed for that. And we know it's false because over time, emails were released by the State Department against their will by court order, which showed that as Hillary Clinton was on TV telling the American public it was a spontaneous demonstration because of a video, she was telling her daughter and some Arab country leaders that it was a planned terrorist attack, which it was. And so we know that it was a lie, and it caused this guy's life to go into a downturn. He served a year in prison for the probation violation. He is now living in a homeless shelter at a church in California. He can't get a job. He's completely poverty-stricken. Now, he's had his troubles in his life, but Hillary Clinton, I don't think, has ever apologized for making those statements about the video, and she essentially destroyed this guy's life.
Yeah, who, by the way, is not some, redneck, Muslim-hating guy. This is an Egyptian-born Coptic Christian who scraped together some money to make this video. And I've seen some of the video. It's not Michael Bay level of production values. Nobody would have even seen this video if it were not talked about by the Obama administration and by Hillary Clinton and by others after this Benghazi attack, to blame it on this, which was just so insane. But regardless, we hear so much about, and you talked about this on your piece on legalinsurrection.com, how much they've been fawning over this beauty pageant winner from 20 years ago, who apparently had a word or two said about her weight gain that offended her 20 years ago. And her life certainly is not ruined. She seems to be doing quite well. But here we have a situation where from an awful, awful international event, a huge tragedy where four people died, a heck of a lot more could have died if you've read the book 13 Hours or have seen the movie. And the lie that was perpetuated about it caused one person's life to be thoroughly ruined, and no one seems to care about it.
That's right. And I haven't even seen it really brought up by the Trump campaign. I mean, that would have been perfect in the first debate when Hillary Clinton went into her fat-shaming attack on Trump to say, well, wait a second. You know, I never ruined this woman's life. I've had very little contact with her. Have you ever apologized to this video maker who you falsely blamed for the deaths of four Americans? But he wasn't on his game that night. Maybe it'll come up in the next debate. But even the Trump
campaign
is not mentioning this guy.
That is a great line, you know, because I think that's one of the liabilities and the flaws of Donald Trump's debating style is that he doesn't have the sort of prosecutorial demeanor that like a Chris Christie has or Rudy Giuliani or William Jacobson, where they could actually go through and say, you know, why didn't you want to bring up this woman's name? Why don't we bring up this filmmaker's name whose life you ruined? Instead, he takes a broader picture, like, well, Benghazi, you know, which I don't even know was even mentioned in the first debate. He needs to take it to the step further and say not just Benghazi and this tragedy that you were a part of, but your lie about it and how that disqualifies you and shows a poor, you know, is a poor reflection of your judgment to be president of the United States. And I'm going to use that, William, as a transition to this final question I'm going to ask you about the presidential campaign. But any more about this this filmmaker before we move on?
No, I think we've covered it.
Okay. And how do you say his full name again? Is Nucala Basali Nucala?
Yes, right. His name repeats itself. So it's Nucala Basali Nucala.
Nucala Basali Nucala. I hope we hear that name in the debate on Sunday night. And that's the final question I have for you here. The debate, the polls have been going back and forth. As you noted earlier, you know, Trump was doing well polling-wise before the first debate. You know, by most assessments, Hillary Clinton maybe won that first one. The polls certainly reflect that. If Trump is going to bounce back, he needs to do a lot of things better. But Pennsylvania might be the state that decides this election. They say Trump is doing well in Ohio. Florida, of course, is going to be extremely important. But you live closer to Pennsylvania than we do. Why do you think Pennsylvania is so important? And does Trump have a shot, if he does well on Sunday night, at improving the numbers there?
Well, you know, Pennsylvania is always this dream for Republicans. I mean, they were talking about Mitt Romney possibly winning it. It's a very tough state because of the Philadelphia area. You remember James Carville's line that Pennsylvania is Philadelphia and Pittsburgh with Alabama in between. And, you know, it's really two states, but the population centers vote for the Democrats. So it's always very tough. He had been, prior to the debate, according to the polling, multiple polling, closing the gap to low single digits, 1, 2, 3% Hillary lead. I think one or two polls might have even shown him even. That has now bounced back to 7, 8, 9% Hillary lead. So it's not looking very promising, even though it had been before the first debate. Pennsylvania is important for electoral votes. It's very hard for a Republican to get the necessary number of electoral college votes because the Democrats automatically have California, New York, Illinois, as you know, and a
yes.
whole bunch of other heavy states. There's usually a very narrow path. Pennsylvania, if Trump wins Pennsylvania, based on the current national polling, he may very well win the presidency. If he loses it, he's going to have to put together a string of other states, which are very iffy, like Virginia, Colorado, Nevada, and some other states.
Yes. Pennsylvania has 20 electoral college votes. Ohio has 18. And then it doesn't take a genius to determine that whoever wins those two out of three will most likely be the next president. And it's more likely that Trump, and I'll ask you, is it more likely that Trump will win Ohio and Florida than he will, say, Florida and or Ohio and Pennsylvania?
Yes. I mean, he probably will win Ohio, and he has a very good chance of winning Florida. His chance of Pennsylvania with the current polling is not very good.
Where do you, Matt, where do you, what state do you vote in, William Jacobson?
I vote in New York. Ithaca, New York, about 45 minutes north of the Pennsylvania border. Like I like to say, 10 miles from the middle of nowhere.
You're not too far from the Baseball Hall of Fame, are you?
No, that's in Cooperstown. That's a good hour and 15 minutes or so. We're pretty far west on the way towards Buffalo.
Okay. That's not terribly far from it. Are you a big baseball fan?
I've lost interest over the years, I got to tell you, in a lot of professional sports. The one I really still loved was football, but with everything that's going on with Kaepernick, I'm not going to lose interest in football, but it's just everything's getting politicized these days, and it's really unfortunate for me to see the NFL going that direction as well.
Well, let me make the argument for baseball. I didn't see anyone kneeling on any of the playoff games that have occurred yet during the national anthem. If they did, I missed it. I think politics so far has not infected our national pastime, and the Chicago Cubs are looking really good for the baseball playoffs this year. In any event, William Jacobson, legal insurrection. Anything else you would like to add before we say goodbye?
No, I think we've covered it. I appreciate you having me on.
We appreciate everything you do, and thanks for joining us. William Jacobson, Legal Insurrection. This is the Michael Coogan Show. We'll be right back.